This podcast is brought to you by LMU Munich.
First, let me thank our organizers for inviting me. I'm very honored and delighted to be here and very much looking forward to the papers, which from the abstracts are, I find, extremely exciting, intriguing. And I'm also seeing things that perhaps in my own paper will somehow resonate with some of the others. And so I'm hoping there'll be some interesting interactions as we go along. So let me talk about Nick Stix and Hecate, the dread triplets, as I like to think of them. So in Hesiod's Theogony, Nyx, Styx, and Hecate, three divinities, all non-Olympians, are from either separate, in the case of Nyx, or secondary collateral lines, in the case of Styx and Hecate, of the divine family tree. All three are powerful females in the evolving patriarchal order of Zeus. Thus, they very much represent the other crowd on which our conference is focused. In the Theogony in general, female divinities occupy a formidable role, Gaia especially, in her role as kingmaker and tireless promoter of regime change, must, after basically running the show, face a spectacular defeat at the hands of Zeus, literally having her characteristic solidity melt. She's melting at the climax of the Typhonomicon, that is, Zeus's final battle with her son for supreme power. Only thereafter is she co-opted into the Olympian cosmos by calling a vote among the gods to elect Zeus as their commander-in-chief. The three goddesses to be examined here display no less important prerogatives and powers that could potentially undermine Zeus's supremacy and even cause his downfall. In each case, we see a delicate dance evolve in which possible opposition to Zeus's supremacy is carefully negotiated, and a balance of respect and power is achieved, and the Olympian order maintained. In quite different ways, they're not only absorbed and integrated into Zeus's order, but they're also given critical positions of power that actually serve to uphold that order. There are many political lessons I think one can learn from the Theogony. Let's begin then with the eldest, Night. Night is demoted in the Hesiodic cosmos from a position of priority that she holds in other Theogonies. We can glimpse the importance of her role and even her absolute primacy in other Theogonies, which to be sure are documented later, but probably reflect older traditions. I mentioned here Aristophanes' Ornithocosmogony in the birds, the Diveni papyrus, where Night is the mother of Uranos, and sundry later so-called Orphic Theogonies. Hesiod demonstrates an awareness of her role when he gives us the first catalog of divinities in the proem to the Theogony, which, as you will remember, works backwards from the reigning powers of Zeus and Hera and ends with, in line 20, Earth and great Oceanus and last named Black Night. I would argue then that Hesiod thereby acknowledges the primacy of Night in other Theogonies, and right from the beginning sets her apart, sets his own cosmogony apart from them. And I think there's another bit of evidence concerning Night's primordial power in Iliad 14, and I know that we'll get some more on that very passage. It's there that Night's offspring, Hypnos, hesitates to lull the Olympian to sleep, as at Hera's bidding, as he once did on another occasion when Hera roused a storm against Heracles. And thereupon, when he woke, he threatened to hurl sleep into the sea. This is line Iliad 14, 258 and following. And he, on awakening, was enraged, hurling the gods around in the palace, and me above all he sought out. And he would have thrust me from the ether into the sea and caused me to disappear, unless Night, who tames both gods and men, had not saved me. In flight, I came to her, and he stopped, even though he was angry. For out of respect, he feared to fall out of Night's good graces. The Iliad passage does not explicitly elucidate why Zeus should show such respect for Night's powers, but she is here characterized as Metera Theon Kai Andron. In Hesiod's own account of the earliest events of cosmogony, Erebus and Night are the offspring in what must be considered an asexual splitting of the primordial protistos house. The two siblings mate sexually to produce their positive counterparts, Aether and Day, bright Aether and bright Day. In addition to embodying the qualities of darkness and light, respectively, both Erebus and Aether also have a spatial dimension. Erebus, the darkness below the earth, Aether, the brightness above it. Their spatial dimension contrast with Night and her daughter Day, who both also have a temporal dimension. Later on in the Works and Days, which I think of as a complement to the Theogony, time will be measured by the constellations that define the seasons and by the sun and moon that define the months, days, and the hours. But this earliest phase of the cosmos and a prerequisite for its evolution requires the alternation of Night and her daughter Day. Temporality thus makes possible the narrative of the first act of the succession myth, which follows. But interestingly enough, Hesiod delays the account of Night's further offspring until after his narrative of that first act of the succession myth. Gaia's anguish, her desire for revenge, for Uranus's outrage, at thwarting the natural processes of birth, and thus the unfolding of the cosmos, Cronus's declaration of his willingness to punish his father's outrage, the castration engineered by his mother Gaia, and its consequences, all of these precede our taking up again the line of Night and her maleficent brood. In fact, the evil forces that have come into being in the world now emerge first and foremost as the offspring of Night. In the narrative that has preceded, we see words like apate, deception, philotes, nekea, Eris, the Erinyes, and various kinds of suffering and grief, ponoi, oidzeus. They've made their appearance in the narrative before they appear as personified forces. While the preceding narrative of Uranus's castration enacted what subsequently became Night's personified children, in other words, their prehistory, let's now trace their activity in the subsequent development of the cosmos after their birth as personified abstractions. The Titanomachy is especially rich in the vocabulary recalling the children of Eris. On occasion, as ordinary nouns, but sometimes also in verbal or adjectival forms. So forms of Eris occur three times in the Titanomachy and also in the Prometheus passage. Panos, Algea, Androctesias, Hysminae, all of them make their appearance in the Titanomachy as Dumachai, three times. And the Styx episode, which I'll discuss later, also displays a cluster of such terms, Eris, Nekia, Pseudos, Chorkos, and so on. So we see what were named as abstract personification actually acting in the narrative. No, in the catalog of Night's offspring, and Eris's offspring, Apollos, two members of this unholy family are explicitly connected with human beings. Nemesis is named as a paimathne toisi brotoisi, a bane to mortal men, 223, and Horkos, hos de pleiston epichonius anthropus pemaine, hotekentis hekon epiorkon omose, who harms men on earth most of all whenever someone willingly swears falsely. That's line 2, 31, and 2. So there's explicitly referred to human beings. Nemesis, we learn later in the Works and Days, along with Eidos, has her habitation among human beings. But both she and Eidos will abandon mankind to their fate and return to Olympus when men have completely sunk into the slough of depravity. By labeling Horkos a bane to human beings who inhabit the earth, I think Hesiod gestures proleptically to what will become a central pillar of Zeus's regime, that is, the Horkos, which is a bane to human beings, i.e. the Horkos by the Styx, who is explicitly called a paimathaoisi, a bane to the gods, and which, so to speak, tames divine oath by creating an automatic mechanism that regulates any transgressions on the part of the gods. Other members of Night's baneful clan, by definition, belong to the human lot and are therefore prominent in the Works and Days. Geras, old age, occurs three times, and Thanatos three times, Care, several times, including Keri Trepheon Anthropon, the expression mortals or human beings who nurture death. Androctesias also occurs, Momos, Phonos, Ponos, Oides, Moira, Oloe, Limos, seven times, Algea, four times, Nekos, six times, Pseudos, three times, Ate, four times, and that also occurs once in the Theogony. So all of these words occur in the Works and Days, and that, I think, is of some importance. For the most part, then, the children of Night and those of her daughter Eris are to be found active in the Works and Days, and that is within the compass of human life. This, of course, is most obvious in the case of Eris, who, as we shall see in discussing Styx, is neutralized in the divine sphere. She now abides among human beings on Earth and has been split into two Eridaes, the bad one, with whom we are familiar from the Theogony, and a new one, a good Eris, whom Zeus has buried in the roots of the Earth. This dual nature of Eris on Earth reflects the ambiguous status of mankind, for whom Eris, like Eidos, may be either good or bad. It is, however, worth noticing that at the ends of the works and days, the good Eris has evidently disappeared, as we learn from the ill-omened fifth day. I think this is number one on your handout. Avoid the fifth days of the months, for they are harsh and dreadful. For they say that on the fifth day the Erinnes attended Oath as he was being born, Oath whom Eris bore to be a bane to perjurers. So here we only have the bad Eris. Things go downhill in the course of the works and days, as I've argued. So with her children accounted for and largely shipped off to trouble human beings, Hesiod returns to matriarchal Night in his description of the underworld and to her earliest manifestation and primal prerogative as mother of day. She and her daughter alternate as they make their daily journey, regulating time, the year, the seasons, the days, the calendar, which, as Hesiod will instruct us, regulates and guides the life of human beings who are subject to time, unlike the gods who are aeontes. Let me now turn to Styx. Hesiod's presentation of this divinity is somewhat unusual. On three different occasions, she comes to the fore in the poem, which gives her a kind of special prominence. She keeps popping up. And I think it's up to us to figure out the connection that links these appearances. First, we learn of her birth, 361. She's named last of the Okeanids, that is, offspring of Tethys and Okeanos, whom Homer, we remember, calls the Genesis Panton. Here again, we find hints of another rival cosmogony, doubtless adapted from Near Eastern models, which begins with the mingling of the sweet and the salt waters, as with Tiamat and Apsu in the Enuma Elish. Hesiod, I believe, again demonstrates an awareness of such cosmogonies by placing Okeanos first in his list of Titans, that's line 133, and Tethys last. Moreover, after he's given the catalog of the Pontids and the monster clan, which are part of the Pontids, Hesiod gives the offspring of Okeanos and Tethys priority in his account of the Titan line. First come the rivers, which are all male, then the Okeanids, whose catalog comes to a close with Styx, she who is most outstanding of all of them. Hadesveon prosferestate estin hapaseon. Perhaps her special status is to be linked to the fact that she in some sense combines both the masculine and feminine features of her siblings, insofar as she alone is a female river. Peculiar. Moreover, this formula, proferestate est apaseon, occurs only one other time in the Theogony. The same expression is used of the muse Calliope in the proem. We discover there that she merits that epithet because of her influence over kings to whom she grants persuasive speech, i.e. her relationship to power. And Styx, too, we will so shortly learn, has a special relation to political power. More than 20 lines later, That special connection becomes clear when we learn about her children, begotten by that rather colorless Pallas. Somebody can help me with Pallas, I'd be delighted. This is number two on your handout. Styx, daughter of Okeanos, mingling with Pallas, gave birth to Zelos, to victory of the loathly ankles in the halls, and strength and might she bore renowned children. It's hard to imagine any ruler who would not wish to possess the permanent allegiance of such forces at his side. Although they're produced through sexual means, these offspring of Styx, like knights, are personified abstractions. And like knights, Styx's power is expressed through her children. Three, I think, handout. Theirs is no home apart from Zeus, nor any seat, nor any road where he does not lead the way. But always they keep their place by deep thundering Zeus. Zeus's adoption, if I can call it that, of Styx's children is immediately followed by an account of the Olympian king's offer to the assembled gods before the Titanomachy. Number four on your handout. And he said that whoever the gods would fight with him, he would not strip him of his prerogatives, but each one of them would keep those he had before among the immortal gods. And he said that the one who had none and was dishonored under Cronos would take possession of both as is right and proper. Apparently neglected under the Ancien Régime, Styx was the first to take up Zeus's offer, bringing along her children. And Zeus lives up to his side of the bargain too, accomplishing what he had promised. Not only by honoring Styx, but also giving her extraordinary gifts, Perisadora, not only adopting her children, but also making her the great oath of the gods. Here we seem to have one of those first acts of mutual respect and reciprocity that will characterize Zeus's regime, which will not only be founded exclusively on Kratos and Bia, but also on Themis, hey Themis esti. Two details perhaps are worth noting. We learned that even before Zeus's offer, Styx had planned to entrust her children to Zeus. And shortly after that, the alacrity of her acceptance was due to the devices of her father, Dia Media Patros, 398. Who is that? Her father's Okeanos. And we note in passing, traditionally, that Okeanos was said not to take part in the Titanomachy. That's the tradition that comes from elsewhere, but may be relevant here. So the permanence of Zeus's regime requires his possession of unassailable might and force, Bia and Kratos. Zeus, so to speak, needs Styx more than she needs him. Without her children, especially her daughter Victory at his side, he cannot defeat the Titans. In fact, in his speech to the Hundred Handers, when he urges them to join his cause, Zeus evokes three of the four children of Styx, and I've given you that passage. I think it's handout five. Already he's addressing them, exhorting the Hundred Handers to join his cause. Already we have fought against each other for a long time, every day for victory and strength, the Titan gods and those who were born from Cronos. You show forth now your great force and irresistible hands against the Titans in baneful battle. So these are really the children of Styx that he needs to succeed. By willingly consigning her children to Zeus, Styx serves as a guarantor of the Olympian order. So Zeus rewards her by making her the great oath of the gods, the Pema Theoisi mentioned at line 400, but its nature and its mechanism are only described much later toward the end of the description of the underworld. So it's delayed and given prominent part 775-806, so a chunk of lines. Given her great benefactions to Zeus, we might at first be surprised to find Styx confined to the netherworld, near the palace of Hades and Persephone. That may, in fact, have been her original habitat. But at Zeus's invitation, before the Titanomachy, she made her journey to Olympus and apparently left her children there to abide with Zeus. It then appears that she returns to the underworld, but now with those extraordinary gifts that Zeus has bestowed on her. Her journey from the nether regions to the upper world and her return to the world below, but now with honors from Zeus, resembles in a way the trajectory of the hundred-handers, who were first unbound, brought into the light by Zeus, but later returned to their abode below. But like Styx, not only with a position of honor, but with a crucial role to play as prison guards of the Titans, in the case of the hundred-handers, and I think in the case of Styx, the guardian of the oath of the gods. The further description of Styx's habitat is rendered difficult by the fact that while she's called the eldest daughter of backflowing Okeanos, she's simultaneously depicted as both a river and a goddess. In fact, her abode, in some ways, resembles that of the monsters, perhaps most of all of Echidna, and her haunt. That's described like this. There is her cave down under a hollow rock, far from immortal gods and mortal men. There, in fact, the gods granted her to inhabit her famous home. That's Echidna. Styx's habitat, and this is handout number 6, is quite similar. Apart from the gods, she inhabits a famous home, roofed over with tall rocks, and round about in every direction, it is fixed with silver columns reaching toward heaven. As a river, we learn, her chilly waters flow down from a steep rock, apparently the only branch of encircling Okeanos and containing one-tenth of his waters. Hesiod then explains at some length the mechanism of the gods' oath. Whenever strife and quarrel arise among the gods and one of them lies or forswears, alluding, as I mentioned before, to those four of the brood of night, strife, quarrels, lies, and perjury. The present tense used throughout the description of the mechanism of the oath reveals that this punitive protocol still obtains among the gods. It's still with us. So by making Styx its guardian, Zeus both compensates her for his adoption of her children and at the same time makes her literally a pillar of his new order. As for those silver columns, I've argued elsewhere that Styx's columns form the counterpart on the east to the more famous pillars of Atlas on the far west, which are also part of the geography of Hesiod's lower world. Like the hundred-handers, whose gigantic physical powers might be problematic for Zeus, after the defeat of the Titans, Styx also abides in the netherworld. And like the hundred-handers, her power embodied in her mighty children is not only neutralized, but harnessed by Zeus to perform a critical function under his new dispensation by removing the future threats of divine dissension. Now I come to the last of my redoubtable triplets, the goddess Hecate. Unlike the other two divinities that I've discussed, Hecate doesn't have a powerful progeny, neither negative forces like Night's offspring, nor the formidable political forces embodied in Styx children. And unlike Styx, who has a mighty entourage of 3,000 rivers and 2,999 nymphs as her brothers and sisters, Hecate has no sisters and no brothers. She is an only child. What this means is that her commanding presence in the Theogony is due neither to her children nor to her siblings, but rather to her ancestry. Why her lineage should endow her with such a special status that it requires over 40 lines to elaborate is not immediately apparent. But I think if we look at her genealogy, we see that she stands at the confluence of several great lines. And I think I've included the genealogy chart. Is it there? Sorry. Let me explain it a bit. Hecate's mother, here's Hecate, is Asteria, who is the sister of Leto. Her father, Hecate's father, is Perses, whose parents are the Titan Creos and Eurybia, the offspring of Gaia and Pontus. Now we know that the Pontids, for the most part, keep to themselves and do not mingle with the Uranides, with the offspring of Gaia and Uranos. The union of Hecate's parents, Asteriae and Perses, forms an exception to that rule. Moreover, their union, and this is really interesting, their union is marked by the first occurrence in the Theogony of the term acoitis, here as their marriage. So their daughter, Hecate, is the fruit of the first genuine marriage in the whole Theogony. Thus, Hecate, in her person, combines the two great lines that emanate from both, from Gaia, both the Uranids and the Pontids. Moreover, the position she occupies in the Theogony right before the birth of the Olympians and Zeus make her in some sense the last of the old gods and at the crossroads of the old and new order, while uniting in her person the lines of Gaia Uranos and Gaia Pontus. It is then on the basis of her powerful bloodlines, even though the gods, we know, don't have blood, that we learn that she received great honors from all the gods under the reign of Cronos, honors that are somehow linked to her genealogy, that is, her share of honors of earth, heaven, and sea, which form part of that impressive lineage, and that she retained those orders when Zeus came to power. And in addition, the Olympian added to those honors, making her a kurotrophos, one who nurtures the young and brings them to adulthood. One thing I want to emphasize is that Hecate in Hesiod is not chthonic at all. Because we think of the later Hecate, who is connected with all sorts of chthonic things, but Hesiod is not. So, Hecate's unique genetic makeup, if I can call it that, explains the unique honors she possessed from the beginning, we're told. Unlike Styx, who was apparently locked out of those of that pre-Olympian Dasmos distribution of honors. As we hear repeatedly, she had a share of honors among the gods, embracing earth, sea, and sky under the old order, and she retains them under the new dispensation. But what did she do with those honors? With such vast spheres of influence, to what areas were her prerogatives assigned? It is by no means clear how her timai were dispensed in the era of Kronos, but we're informed of the goddess's present prerogatives under Zeus's regime. And like the description of Styx's honors, Hecate's are described in the present tense and therefore permanently abiding. The impressive catalog of her spheres of influence show Hecate to be involved in all aspects of human life. But not just human life, but life as we know it. That is, human life in the post-Promethean era. And I've given you the long passage, handout 7, describing her, her aratology. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's clear that Hecate's powers pervade all aspects of human life, from the highest to the lowest, from the top to the bottom of the social scale. And although not acting independently of the other gods, human success or failure depend on her goodwill. Her partnership with Poseidon and with Hermes seemed to cover earth and sea, which brings me to a question. What about the omission of heaven from Hecate's prerogatives? Since we're told she has a share not only of earth and sea, but also of heaven. Most striking of all is the resonance of the last phrase in that passage. If in her heart she is willing, from few she increases, and from many she makes few. Ex oligon briare, caec polon meona atheken. Similarity with this, with the litany of Zeus's powers that opens the works and days is indeed striking. Easily, we're told, and 8, he strengthens and easily he impairs the strong. Easily he diminishes the conspicuous and increases the unnoticed. Easily he strengthens the crooked and blasts the proud, high-thundering Zeus who inhabits the highest domains. While at the same time suggesting a pronounced similarity between Zeus's powers over mankind and those of Hecate, these lines also point to an important difference. While the Hecate passage reiterates the goddess's closeness to human beings, paragignita, parastesa, the final verse from the Works and Days, high-thundering Zeus, who inhabits the highest domains, hypertata domata naie, emphasizes the Olympian's distance from mortals. It's Hecate's intervention that culminates that gap. Now, some time ago, I argued for the critical importance of Hecate for Hesiod's theology, an importance that fully justifies those 42 lines that he devotes to the goddess, but which have seemed to some critics to be interpolation or due to some kind of personal quirk on Hesiod's part. I'm not going to rehearse my earlier arguments here, but only give a kind of brief summary. Hesiod's Hecate differs both from the later figure with her connections to witchcraft, dogs, clownic associations, and she can also not really be identified with the great mother goddess worshipped in Caria. The Theogony's Hecate is a construct, that takes its bearings from Hesiod's etymologizing of her name, deriving her name from formulas like Hecate Dios, by the will of Zeus. Hesiod assigns to her the key prerogative of mediating between mankind and the Olympian gods. She is the divinity through whose will prayers are fulfilled or denied, sacrifices accepted or rejected. As an inscrutable and sometimes capricious intermediary, her interventions of refusing or granting human pleas, requests, or vows resolve what is surely the most fundamental problem of all theology. Why, despite everything, I've done everything right, I've been a good person, I sacrificed properly, I invoked the god properly, why have my pleas, my prayers, my sacrifices fallen on deaf ears? Why have my offerings failed to move the gods? Or on other occasions, why have they been successful? Whether accepted or rejected, Hecate has intervened. All depends on her will, Hecate Dios. Now, it's interesting that Hesiod brings out the character of Hecate as an intermediary through the way he structures the whole lengthy episode. And I'll just give you a quick outline. I haven't given you the whole text. 412, 415, the goddess honors from Zeus and the gods. 416, 420, the goddess influence on the human sphere. 421, 429, the goddess honors among the gods and Zeus. 430, 447, the goddess influence on human life. 448, 452, the end, her honors among the gods and Zeus. So we can see there's a kind of vacillation, which in fact enacts her mediating position. So it encapsulates her function as a mediator between the two spheres. Stylistically, too, there's a high number of verbal repetitions which give the passage an incantatory feeling, and these contribute to an understanding of the goddess's role and justify, I think, her prominence in Hesiod's theology. Time, the word time occurs again and again, amora times, etc. To timene, timene lachon, emmore times, tiete autain, emmore times, ho dethele, hon kethelesin, hois kethelesi, hois kethelesi, ethelusa gethumo, thumo gethelusa. So these two aspects, the honor in which he is held, and her willingness, or the dependence on her will. I would say she's not always willing, and that's in fact her purpose, to withhold or grant. Now, so far we've seen how Hesiod chose Zeus dealing with and accommodating some of the more problematic, because powerful, and female divinities. For the most part, night's noxious offspring are either neutralized or sent off to plague mankind. Styx's powerful children remain on Olympus in Zeus's thrall, but she herself, while confined to the lower world, nevertheless contributes to the stability and smooth functioning of Olympus. Zeus's dealings with Hecate are more complex because she herself poses more complex problems, or we might even say potential threats, given the high degree of honor in which she is held by the gods both old and new. The vastness of her powers distributed over the threefold parts of the cosmos must be accommodated, but also restrained. Zeus's solution both recognizes and harnesses those powers, consigning her neither to the underworld, like Styx, nor sharing Olympus with her. And I think I mentioned at some point when I was thinking about her that he does not marry her. She would be a perfect wife. If you think of the idea of an epikleros who brings her inheritance with her, he doesn't. And maybe that was a good move. So he doesn't share Olympus with her. Instead, he restricts her sphere of activity to the earth and the sea, which form her inheritance, to the world of human beings, with its kings and games and courts and fishermen and herders. Emblematic there is Zeus's additional reward in making her a Kurotrophos, who oversees the maturing of mortal youth, a prerogative that likewise binds her to the world of human beings. Like night, like Styx, Hecate is both integrated into Zeus's order, performing an essential function as intermediary. As an only child, Munogenes, with no siblings to dilute her genetic makeup, she absorbs into her own person the formidable powers of her inheritance. But she's also, shall we say, declawed or defanged by becoming a dead end genealogically. Unlike Night, unlike Styx, she has no children that must be accommodated so as not to trouble the eternal serenity of Olympus. Thank you.